The matter of John Saluzzo, may we please have appearances at counsel?
Thank you. Christina Blunda, Deputy Ethics Counsel with the Office of Attorney Ethics.
Good afternoon, everyone. Robert Ramsey on behalf of the respondent.
Is respondent present?
Recording in progress.
We sent him a notification. I know he's been waiting all day to get on, so if he's not with us now, he'll be with us momentarily. We can start with Adam.
All right, let's do so. Ms. Blunda.
Please go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, Associate Justices. We're here after a hearing that resulted in a recommendation of a 6-month suspension, and the Disciplinary Review Board has made an alternate finding. By way of background, the OAE has charged the respondent with 5 RPC violations, knowing misappropriation, and the principles of In re Wilson and In re Hollandonner in knowingly appropriating the assets of the estate of Mary Grimley that were due to respondent's mother, Jane Saluzzo, and his sister, Jane Atkins, who I will refer to as Atkins. RPC 1.15, and that he failed to promptly disperse the funds to all the beneficiaries but himself. RPC 8.4b, in that his handling of the estate funds was theft, contrary to 2C 20-9. RPC 8.4C, in that he was deceitful and dishonest in his handling of the distribution of the assets. And RPC 8.4C, in that he was deceitful and dishonest in his solicitation of false notarizations of powers of attorney for both Mary Grimley and his mother, Jane Saluzzo. There was a stipulation of facts in which almost all of the facts were stipulated to, and 3 of the charges were stipulated to, and those were failure to promptly turn over funds and 8.4C deceit in handling of the 2 notarizations. The issues at in dispute were knowing misappropriation, theft of funds, and fraud, deceit, and dishonesty in the handling of the estate. There are a couple of issues. One is the background information that was supplied in the summation brief by the OAE. And this case was tried over the matter of a course of 2 days, during which the respondent did not object to any of the evidence that was put in regarding the background of Mr. Saluzzo with his mother and his aunt, and the hundreds of thousands of dollars in checks that were made out to the respondent after the improper notarization of the powers of attorney. And I'm not going to go into that evidence except to say that while the special master didn't think it was relevant, the Disciplinary Review Board did, and it was relevant because it showed his sense of entitlement, his habit of taking funds from the elderly relatives, but most importantly, his lack of credibility with regard to signatures on the checks and the preparation of the transfer on death agreement that he had his mother sign just a month or two before she died and after she'd been in the hospital for years. I am happy to go into that if you're not familiar with it, but those are detailed at pages 7, 8, 16, and 17 of the DRB opinion. So unless you want me to, I won't go into them, but I just want to say that I think that they are relevant as to the credibility and the character of the respondent. The special master found not only the stipulated violations, but that the respondent was deceitful and dishonest in his handling of the distribution of the assets, and that the respondent had negligently misappropriated funds belonging to Jane and Atkins, Jane the mother and Jane the sister. And the respondent urges you to rely on the special master's findings of fact. But there are a couple things to consider here. The special master's findings of fact, he found that there was no knowing misappropriation of funds, but that was not only unsupported by the facts at the hearing, but it's contradictory to his own ruling in finding that there was negligent misappropriation, because he found that the OAE had not proven that the respondent was acting as the attorney of the estate And therefore, he could not have knowingly misappropriated the funds because they were not a client. However, in making his determination that the respondent violated RPC 8.4C in performing his fiduciary duties, the special master pointed to the following facts as providing, quote, more than sufficient relationship to the practice of law, end of quote. One, that respondent's letter to his sister on December 19th, 2007 suggested that the amount she received was the total amount to which she was entitled when the final amount was either undetermined or respondent should have known that she was entitled to more. Two, that the respondent knew that his sister and he were equal beneficiaries and also equally entitled to the shares of their father and brother who had predeceased them, and so they were entitled to their shares. And that he sent his sister only $28,750 while he had received $125,000 by then. This was December 19th, 2007. Three, that respondent used office letterhead in dispatching the bond and release to Ms. Atkins. Four, that respondent used office letterhead in filing the refunding bond and release. Five, that respondent listed himself as attorney on the refunding bond and release. Six, that respondent was listed as the attorney on the estate tax returns, and he took an attorney's fee. If these facts provide more than sufficient relationship to the practice of law for a violation of RPC 8.4C, they must provide sufficient relationship to the practice of law for a violation of RPC 1.15, knowing misappropriation. At page 21 of its opinion, the DRB quoted the special master in his finding with regard to negligent misappropriation. And he said, the special master determined that the OAE had proven by, quote, a standard well beyond clear and convincing evidence, end of quote, that, quote, there is sufficient conduct related to respondent's practice of law to warrant a finding of negligent misappropriation under RPC 1.5A. The OAE had proven by a standard well beyond clear and convincing evidence that there's sufficient conduct. Since the OAE had proven that there was sufficient evidence related to respondent's practice of law that could warrant a finding of negligent misappropriation, they must have provided sufficient evidence related to the practice of law to show that there was a violation of 1.5A, knowing misappropriation. You can't have the practice of law in for part of the rule and not the practice of law for the other. The DRB went on to determine that by dispersing $140,350 to himself, not including his executor's fee of $15,000 and his attorney's fee of $7,500 from the Grimley estate account, which was $48.32 more than he was entitled to, and that takes into account after he reimbursed $30,000 to the estate to pay the estate taxes. He did all this without the consent or authorization of the additional beneficiaries. Respondent knowingly misappropriated funds entrusted to him in violation of RPC 1.15A and the principles of Wilson and Hollandonner. They went on to say that as the executor, the respondent owed a fiduciary duty to the beneficiaries of the estate, citing In re Fulcher 224 NJ 496 at 511, a 2016 case. The DRB also found that despite the respondent's assertion that he was not acting in his capacity as an attorney during his handling of the Grimley estate, the evidence of the record provides otherwise, because the respondent took the legal fee of $7,500. He communicated with the Grimley estate beneficiaries via letters on his firm's letterhead, and he listed himself as the attorney on the refunding bond and release. And they noted that an attorney-client relationship is not necessary in order to find knowing misappropriation, citing In re McHugh, 153 NJ 365, 1998, and In re Meenan, 156 NJ 401, 1998. At page 32 of its decision, the DRB analyzed negligent versus knowing misappropriation in this particular case. And they found knowing misappropriation for the following reasons. One, respondent was acutely aware of the terms of Brimley's will. Two, more importantly, he was aware that he was an equal beneficiary with his sister Atkins. Three, despite that knowledge, he repeatedly dispersed funds to himself from the Brimley estate account and not to Atkins. I'm going to sidetrack from that list for a second to refer you to OAE 19, which is in the OAE exhibits that you can look at later, but I will read to you the distributions that he made beginning November of 2006. I won't give you the specific dates, but in November, he dispersed to himself a check of $2,500. In December, he dispersed to himself a check of $5,000. In February, he dispersed a check for $10,000 and a check for $5,000 to himself. In July, he dispersed a check for $17,500 to himself. In August, he dispersed two checks to himself, one for $12,500, one for $10,000. Then in October, he issued three checks to himself, one for $10,000, one for $10,000, one for $30,000. And then in November, he issued two checks to himself, $2,500 and $10,000. So during that time frame, he issued $125,000 worth of checks to himself. He gave his mother one check for $2,500 and gave his sister nothing. Now, there is no way that that systematic taking of funds was negligent and not knowing. So they said, despite that knowledge, he repeatedly dispersed funds to himself from the Brimley estate account and not to Atkins, and that's what they're referring to. Number four, this is not a case where respondent negligently erred by dispersing an incorrect amount of funds to Atkins or by mistakenly calculating her share. Number five, rather, respondent failed to provide Atkins any funds until he dispersed funds to the additional lesser beneficiaries. Now, I'm assuming that you're familiar with all of the facts of the case, so that you would know that there were initially seven beneficiaries who were equal, and then once it was established that his brother, that respondent's brother and father had predeceased Ms. Brimley, those shares went to the respondent, his sister, and his mother. And then his mother died before the estate was totally administrated. So both the respondent and his sister became equal beneficiaries, having taken their mother's portion also. So rather, this is number five, respondent failed to provide Atkins any of the funds until he dispersed the funds to the additional lesser beneficiaries. So there were two lesser beneficiaries, the church and a woman whose name begins with M, and I lost it for a second. But they were what I'll call the lesser beneficiaries. Number six is, then he dispersed to her the same amount as the lesser beneficiary. So he treated her as a lesser beneficiary. Atkins received, number seven, $28,750 from respondent, well short of the $69,611.68 she was entitled to receive, and well less than the $125 he had already dispersed to himself. Number eight, moreover, the respondent failed to disperse funds to Atkins until more than a year after he began dispersing funds to himself, and Atkins had not given permission to the respondent to withhold or use her funds. So they determined that this misappropriation was done knowingly, despite any shoddy bookkeeping practices that the respondent asserted were the cause of his misappropriation. With regard to poor bookkeeping, the DRB cited In re Johnson, 105 New Jersey, 249 at 260, 1987, for the proposition that the intentional and purposeful avoidance of knowing what is going on in one's trust account will not be deemed a shield against proof of what would otherwise be a, quote, knowing misappropriation. Within our ethics system, there is sufficient sophistication to detect the difference between intentional ignorance and legitimate lack of knowledge. the DRB possesses that sufficient sophistication. Obviously, so does the court. I would like to make one more note that the respondent has raised an argument that the DRB has created a new rule of law that would extend Wilson discipline to attorneys who are the executors of estates, in which they are also beneficiaries. And I say that is a misstatement of the law. As the DRB found, although we find that the respondent, this is a quote, although we are finding that respondent was acting as an attorney in representing the Grimley estate, even if he were not, there is simply no law or case that supports a, quote, family exception to the rule of Wilson and In re Hollandonner. End of quote. It doesn't matter if the respondent was a beneficiary and some of the funds in the account belonged to him. What he did was to knowingly misappropriate the funds that did not belong to him. All attorneys in the state of New Jersey are aware that they cannot use funds that belong to their clients or others that are in an account for safekeeping by the respondent. The DRB decision is correct. The respondent must be disbarred for both the knowing misappropriation of client funds and the theft of estate funds. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, anyone? Mr. Ramsey, please go ahead.
Your Honor, may I please the court? Your Honor, Ms. Blunda, who is my wonderful dear colleague, and I tried this matter for 2 days. And with all the solemnity and austerity and dignity that you would find in any trial of the Superior Court of New Jersey, we both put our hearts and souls into the case. She called her witnesses, I called mine, I had my expert, she had hers. The respondent testified at great length. And we tried this case before someone who will go down in the annals of the storied history of this court, of the judiciary in New Jersey, as one of the giants. He'll rank right up there with Justice Clifford and Chief Justice Hughes and so many other giants that we've been so fortunate to have in our state.
We'll stipulate to that.
Thank you, Your Honor, because it's important. Judge Stern put his heart and soul into this case, and he watched everything happening like a hawk, took extensive notes, solicited arguments from us all along the way, engaged and heard us in an extensive closing argument, and at the end asked for briefs from us at the end, and we did that. And he gave it his full thought and consideration and came up with the opinion that your honors have seen from him. And I really didn't know how to address this whole issue until 10 days ago when this court published its decision in In re Robert Telly. And there's some unbelievably important language in pages 24 and 25 of the slip opinion, which talks about the level of deference that should be accorded by a court on a trial de novo for the opportunity of the trial level judge to make determinations about credibility, to get a feel of the case, to hear the tone of voice and the visual expressions and the glance of the eye and things of that nature, all the things that go into making credibility determinations from human beings. And the court was really kind of very clear on the importance of this in making your determination as the final arbiters of both the facts and the law in these types of cases. And I'm going to suggest to Your Honor and the other justices on this panel that Judge Stern made his determinations. He found that the Office of Attorney Ethics had not proven its case to the standard of clear and convincing evidence, okay? And he notes that time after time after time in his opinion. Now, I don't wanna criticize the DRB because it really doesn't matter at this point. The de novo review is being done by this body. But I will note on page 23 of their opinion, the court says the following, the DRB said the following: contrary to the special master's finding that respondent did not knowingly misappropriate funds in the Grimley estate and did not commit a theft of funds, we determine the record clearly and convincingly supports that respondent is guilty of those violations. There is absolutely zero mention by the DRB of any level of deference that would be due to Judge Stern for the factual determinations he made. typically in the appellate division, for example, if one of the appellate division is reviewing factual findings of a trial level judge, not facts found by a jury, but facts found by the judge on a motion or whatever it may be, they will always sustain that unless there's some real sense of wrongness. Something really was bad in this decision. It's really kind of a gut reaction. And the DRB completely eliminates that. They don't have one single peep in here about any level of deference that's due to Judge Stern, nor do they say why he was wrong with his specific factual findings. They just skip over that and move on to the conclusion that they wanted to reach in this matter. Now, I would suggest to all of you that since 1979, there's probably been in excess now of 500 attorneys who have been disbarred as a result of the In re Wilson decision in 1979. And as my adversaries just indicated, all the attorneys in the state either know or should know what goes into a Wilson case. It's basically very, very simple. You know, did you take the money? Yes. Did you take it from client? Yes. Did you have your client's permission? No. And did you do it knowingly? Yes. Those are the essential elements of Wilson. And I'm going to suggest to this court that those are missing from this case. This did not involve a trust account, as we all know. It involved an estate wherein the respondent was a primary substantial beneficiary. So some of the money that he was taking, and he did this, of course, with the understanding that this is his own money, it distinguishes it from the typical Wilson case where the attorneys are dealing with monies that are not their money. They don't have any claim to it. In fact, attorneys in New Jersey, they can't mix their own, commingle their own funds with trust account funds to prevent this exact thing from happening. That's not the case when you're dealing with an estate for which you're not only the executor, and by the way, you don't have to be an attorney to be an executor of an estate, but also you're a substantial beneficiary.
Okay, can I ask you a question? I know that you're toggling between this is negligent misappropriation to he's not acting as attorneys. So I get that. If we're in Wilson land, then obviously this has to be a knowing misappropriation. So I want to understand your position. When an attorney is the administrator of an estate, are you saying that a Wilson-like approach should not apply if the attorney, whether he's writing letters on his letter or not, who knowingly, and I'll use the word steals, he has the intention of permanently depriving the heirs of an estate of money in order to enrich himself. Are you saying that a Wilson-like approach would not be appropriate?
I am not saying that at all, Justice Alvin. And I hope I pointed this out sufficiently in my brief, but let me just kind of focus in on this. Because the cases that were cited by the DRB and by the Office of Attorney Ethics all dealt with attorneys who were administering estates. And by the way, they were a pretty thin rule. Only one of them was ever litigated. The others were defaults or a reciprocal discipline out of Florida. But they all dealt with attorneys who were just, you know, they were functioning as the administrators of estates, but they didn't have any personal skin in the game. They were not involved as a beneficiary in the estate. I couldn't find any New Jersey cases dealing with a situation where an attorney serves in the dual role of not only is he an administrator of the estate, but he also is a substantial beneficiary. So it's not In re Wilson in the sense that, you know, he's taking other people's money. He's entitled to much of the money that he took. Your Honor,
he's entitled to $125,000 and the other two are entitled to $2,500?
No, Your Honor, not at all.
Is it that what happened? Is it that what he took?
He negligently took
his mother $2,500 and his sister zero, correct?
No, that's not what happened. His sister got a substantial amount of money, just she didn't get as much as she was entitled to. The point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is this. He took distributions to himself, but he didn't keep adequate records to know when his distributions would stop and when they would be invading basically the corpus of the trust that belonged to other individuals. My adversary brought up was listed some of the checks that were taken to him, you know, starting, I think the first one she mentioned was $2,500 and then another amount and another amount. Well, the argument could be very simple that the money that he took initially, he had a claim of right to that money because it was his money, you know, as a beneficiary under the estate. But because of rotten bookkeeping, at some point he crossed the line and started taking money that he would not be entitled to.
As I understand, he didn't keep records, so then he could pay him. He paid himself more because he didn't know he was paying himself more. Is that the argument?
That's correct. That is exactly correct.
And it was his duty to keep records, but he didn't keep any records, and he paid himself more, and that was inadvertent.
It was negligent, and that was a major issue at the trial level. We had an expert witness who testified to it, reviewed all the bookkeeping or the limited bookkeeping that he did do. And Judge Stern listened to it and found that it was done through negligence, not as a knowing misappropriation, which would otherwise be required under the Wilson standard. So Judge Stern made a big issue also the fact that he really didn't view himself as an attorney in this. He reviewed it as a family matter, and that's why he didn't use the normal bookkeeping procedures that he utilized, say, for example, for a trust account. This is really not a client matter as far as he was concerned. And in a sense, basically the people involved in the estate were not clients. They're beneficiaries under an estate for which he is a fiduciary. What I'm suggesting to Your Honor and to the other members of this court is this, that this is not a knowing misappropriation in the classic sense of Wilson. This is an individual who, through sloppy bookkeeping, did not know when the line was where he would had exhausted the amount of money that he would be legally entitled to, either as an executor fee or alternatively as a part of his pro rata share of the estate. If he kept better records, he would have known at some point he had to stop. And by the way, I have to mention that the corpus of this trust continued to grow while it was being administered, because there were bonds and other pieces of assets that were coming into the estate all the time. So the pro rata share to which respondent was entitled, together with the other beneficiaries, was dynamic. Let's put it that way. We'd be changing all the time. Respondent has to be disciplined if, based upon his lack of negligence, his lack of diligence in dealing with this stuff, the fact that he did not make a timely distribution to these individuals as he was required to do. None of that was ever contested at the hearing. But we don't reach that issue ever unless we get by the Wilson question. Because if it's, everything, Wilson is the key issue in the whole case. Once we've resolved the Wilson case, it's dispositive of the rest of the case.
No, it's not. Because if we buy your argument that it's a negligent misappropriation, we never even have to address the Wilson issue.
You don't address the Wilson.
And that's exactly what Judge Stern found, a negligent misappropriation.
Right.
So it would seem to me that's the first thing we should be determining.
And I would
whether or not this was negligent or willful.
It's the linchpin issue in the entire case. But what I'm suggesting is, and my client will be the second to admit it after me, he has to be disciplined for this, okay? But you never reach legitimate normal discipline levels like a censure, suspension, or whatever it may be. I think Judge Stern recommended a 6-month suspension, which under the circumstances is entirely reasonable. But you don't reach that issue at all until you get by the Wilson question. If this court makes a determination and agrees with Judge Stern that the elements were not proved by clear and convincing evidence, then we move on to regular, normal attorney discipline. And I'm going to suggest to Your Honor that we could not have had a more indulgent, better judge to hear the facts of this case. And I hope that the court will follow his determinations and the record he made here.
Thank you, Mr. Ramsey.
Thank you, Judge.
Mr. Salizzo, would you like to address the court? You have to unmute, and you need not do so. It's entirely optional.
No, I would like to, and thank you for the courtesy, Chief Justice, and to this body as well. Let me just, and Mr. Ramsey has highlighted it, but I want the court at least to know something about me. And I'm somewhat nervous speaking to this court, but I have practiced law in this state and had the honor and privilege of practicing law in this state for over 40 years. I have an unblemished record. I have not even had a complaint from a client over those 40 years. I've always considered this matter involving my cousin Mary's estate as a family matter. I never considered it as an attorney-client relationship. And consequently, as addressed by some of the justices, I did not keep financial records as I would in relationship to a trust account. There was no intent on my part to take more money than I was entitled to from the estate. It was through very poor, if in totally inadequate, bookkeeping and record keeping that led to this to occur. I can only assure this court that if I'm permitted to maintain my license, of course, after any suspension as recommended by Judge Stern, that I'd be permitted to keep my license, I can assure this court that I will never put myself in a same or similar situation that I'm facing here before as I conclude my career. I want to thank this court for this, its time. I also want to publicly thank Mr. Ramsey. Mr. Ramsey's time and effort that he has extended on this matter on my behalf, and also the courtesies that he's extended to both myself and my family. He is truly a credit to our profession, and I want to publicly thank him for his efforts on my behalf, and I thank this court for its time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Saluzzo.
Your Honor, I object.
Mr. Saluzzo, you acknowledge that you took about 70,000 more than you were entitled, correct?
With all due respect, Your Honor,
put 30 back.
I think the calculation somewhere is around $40,000, Your Honor.
Isn't that? Okay. But you took about 70,000 more than you were entitled to, correct?
Yes. Initially, yes.
And then you put about 30,000 back.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
That was over a period of 7 years, I guess 6 years. Over how long a period of time was that?
I think it was 2006 to 2008, like a year and a half administrating the estate.
Is there a reason why the additional 40,000 was never returned? Why the other beneficiaries were not made whole?
Well, the only beneficiary that has not been made whole is my sister, Your Honor. And I don't know how much of the history of this as I consider it a family matter has, but as early as 2000 and well, it came to head in 2008, and we tried to rectify this both with my sister as well as some other of her family members, and they were not willing to accept what was being proposed in terms of mediations and settlements, Your Honor. Thereafter, lawsuits pursued and came about, and judgments were entered against me, which precludes me now from even getting any kind of application for loans that would permit me to repay her the monies of those $40,000. This is a long, protracted matter, Your Honor, that has gone on for 13 years now.
How much money is your sister owed?
From this matter, Your Honor, $40,000 plus dollars, plus whatever interest now has accrued since that period of time. But I'm not in a financial situation where I can go out and put in, get an equity loan on my home, because there have been lawsuits involving her that have caused judgments to be entered against me.
So you're telling us you cannot satisfy that judgment?
The $40,000.
Yeah.
I would not at the present time. I've tried to. I can't just get $40,000, even a loan, because there's judgments against me. It's a terrible situation to be in. I have to be quite honest with the court. I mean, I want the court to appreciate. I have tried with counsel over these 13 years before Mr. Ramsey came in to try to resolve these issues with my sister. We have done that through the federal court and a state court. And every opportunity we did very early on in this process, I'm going to describe it, was thwarted by them.
When did you first learn that you owed your sister the $40,000? And what year was that? And why did you not pay it at that time?
Well, Your Honor, I'm going to tell you that the real calculation of those monies, and I know based on the hearing, the Office of Attorney Ethics says, well, we had a matter in front of Judge Olivieri in Hudson County over some issues on Mary's estate, and there was a calculation by an accountant. But those numbers weren't even real numbers. I must tell you, Chief Justice, that the real calculation was sitting down in Mr. Ramsey's office within the last year plus, when I think before we met with the Office of Attorney Ethics to do my interview, that the hard numbers were presented and the figures which were agreed upon both by Mr. Ramsey, myself, and the Office of Attorney Ethics, was the true number that I appreciated that was owed to my sister.
Set aside the precise number. At what point did you have a sense, did you know that you owed your sister a substantial amount of money?
Oh, when they confronted me in 2008 or 9, Your Honor. And by that, yes, go ahead. I apologize.
No, and at that point in time, did you attempt to pay your sister? What happened then?
I tried to resolve the matters, yes. And I was thwarted in every opportunity. In other words, if I offered X, that wasn't acceptable. They wanted Y.
What does resolve exactly mean? Did you offer to pay the full amount back?
Did you try to offer
a certain amount in return for a release of all claims? What exactly does we tried to resolve it mean? Because the chief asked if you paid it, and you said we tried to resolve it, and it didn't seem responsive to the chief's questions to me.
I will tell you exactly, Your Honor. There was issues of Mary, and there were issues with my mother, and I would try to resolve what I would call a universal resolution of all those matters.
Did that resolution include paying the full amount?
Yes. That was resolution of this and other matters that they were objecting to.
Did you have the money at the time to be able to pay it back in 2008?
What I anticipated having, Judge, there was a piece of property in Hoboken that was my mother's. My mother and Mary lived there over a period of time. Well, they lived there until they both passed. That I shared 50% of that house. I anticipated that upon the sale of that house, I could satisfy everything.
Okay.
And that was thwarted, Your Honor, because of course, then the litigation progressed and members of my profession just got paid and there was not much left from the house. And a matter of fact, based on the judgments, they were offsetted as well. So I was not in a position, to respond to your question, yes. If in fact we did not protract this litigation or disputes between us, and we had looked at the property in Hoboken, that property would have satisfied any monies that was claimed by my sister, including Mary Grimley's estate.
Thank you. Other questions, anyone? Thank you, Mr. Slutsoe. We'll take the matter under advisement.
I thank the court for its time, Judge. I really do, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and thank you, members of the court.
Thank you to counsel as well. We'll take the matter under advisement. Court's in